Welcome to this lecture, entitled The Miraculous Deliverance of William Oakley. It's the second in our series Ordinary People, Extraordinary God, originally scheduled for April. Well, the concept of someone being famous for 5 minutes is well known to us. When an otherwise quite ordinary person who lives a very unremarkable life, which attracts little attention, becomes involved in an incident or an episode when they're catapulted into the public eye for a brief period. Forever afterwards, the whole life is defined by this one moment. If you recall the following names, I'm pretty sure that you'll associate them with only one thing. Do you remember Malcolm Nash, who was the unfortunate Somerset cricketer who happened to be bowling when Gary Sobers scored 6 sixes in one over in 1968? Or Major Charles Ingram, the so-called coughing major, who questionably hit the jackpot on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in 2001? William Oakley, our subject today, is just one such person, known for only one dramatic interlude. Despite the best efforts of historians to discover basic facts like the dates of his birth, marriage or death, or his occupation, so far nothing has been traced. The only thing that we have is William Oakley's own detailed record of his extraordinary experiences that covered a 5-year period between June 1639 and June 1644. Just to put it into context, this occurred during the time that Susanna Bell was living with her family in New England. As we shall see, Oakley too became an exile from his native land, but in very different circumstances. Oakley's account, which didn't appear in print until 1675, 30 years after the events he describes, is a true life adventure story. Today, you could imagine it being made into a film, perhaps starring Tom Cruise or Harrison Ford. And it's interesting that he chooses a ghostwriter, which we think of as being a relatively modern thing, to help him tell the tale. And this suggests that perhaps he wasn't a very educated man, or at least not one who had any confidence in his writing abilities. Several ministers urged him to publish his narrative, but he says that he couldn't be persuaded until a friend taught it, quotes, to speak a little better English. However, he assures his readers that although the trimming and form is another's, the stuff and matter is my own. He also avers that everything is completely true and he's resisted any temptation to over-sensationalise. Essentially, like Susanna Bell's memoirs, William Oakley's book is a story of God's providence running like a string of pearls through everything that happened to him. Thus, Oakley stresses that he's writing with a purpose, not merely to entertain. In the preface, he urges all who read or hear his story to consider seriously whether you have not had many eminent personal deliverances in one kind or another, which this marvellous providence of God towards me may not refresh your memory withal. And if our memories are refreshed, this should awaken us to a new thankfulness to God for all the benefits that he has blessed us with. And this is why Oakley entitles his book Ebenezer, or a small monument of great mercy appearing in the miraculous deliverance of William Oakley. By publishing this biography, Oakley wishes to raise his own personal memorial to God's providence in his life by testifying to the world as the prophet Samuel did in 1 Samuel 7, verse 12, when, after a great deliverance of the people of Israel from the might of the Philistine army, quotes, Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, Hitherto hath the Lord helped us. And this book is Oakley's Ebenezer, his stone of gratitude for God's providential deliverance. The lecture will follow Oakley's story chronologically from beginning to end and conclude with the 8 spiritual lessons that he draws from what has happened to him. The story opens in June 1639, with William setting off from Gravesend aboard the Mary of London, on a voyage bound for the Isle of Providence in the West Indies. Providence Island is a small rocky outcrop, lying about 120 miles east of the coast of Nicaragua, and is now part of Colombia. Providence Island Company had set up the colony in 1631. They were a group of zealous Puritan earls and lords who were concerned about the way things were going in England. Their aim was to establish a base for the Reformed religion in Central America, in the very heart of Spanish territory. And they wanted to challenge the Spanish Catholic dominance of the area at a time when Spanish Habsburg forces were annihilating Protestant churches across continental Europe. And it was part of the same initiative that saw the planting of a settlement in Massachusetts, the destination of Susanna Bell. And initially it was envisaged that Providence Island would become the more important of the two colonies, and that, with its warmer climate and fertile soil, would be the place to which the northern settlers would eventually migrate. In many ways, the two Puritan settlements were in competition for potential colonists. But it wasn't long before Massachusetts decisively won that rivalry. Tens of thousands went there, whereas only a few hundred were persuaded to go to Providence Island. And things didn't work out on Providence Island for a variety of reasons, not least the ever-present threat of Spanish attack, which finally resulted in the extinction of the colony in 1641, after only a decade. By 1639, when Oakley set off for Providence Island, it was an unhappy, divided place, which for economic and defence reasons had been forced to adopt practices far from its original vision. Oakley must have been a young man at the time, but he doesn't tell us what he was going there to do. We know he was not a skilled craftsman, but it's possible that he was a young merchant, or merchant servant, or even an indentured servant who would work for a period of time on the plantation with the promise of freedom and land at the end of the term. Well, the ship that Oakley was on, laden with cargo of supplies and about 60 passengers and crew, was joined by another 2 ships as it made slow progress along the channel, stopping off at the Isle of Wight. 6 days after setting sail from the Isle of Wight, they spotted 3 ships, 3 or 4 leagues to their leeward side. Their ships' captains were unsure whether to stay and speak to these ships or flee from them. While they hesitated, the other ships came closer and they soon discovered they were, quote, Turkish men of war, pirates. By the time that they decided to flee, the corsairs were upon them. And after a brief scuffle, the pirates soon boarded and took all 3 ships. Oakley calls these ships Turkish men of war, but a further word of explanation is required. The ships were actually from Algiers in North Africa. The Turks, or Ottomans, had overrun the Near East and pushed into Europe in the 14th century. In the early 16th century, Algiers was formally annexed to the Ottoman Empire, a decade after inviting 2 Turkish corsairs, one of whom was the famous Barbarossa, to expel the Spanish from its territory. And the Turks governed the region through deputies or viceroys. So Turkish was used as a kind of umbrella term, which included these North African states on what we now call the Maghreb or Barbary Coast. And Algiers became the chief centre of piratical activity. And for over 3 centuries, from about 1500 to 1800, Barbary pirates or corsairs terrorised the Mediterranean but also operated in the Atlantic. They seized the inhabitants of coastal villages in Spain and Italy, as well as capturing ships of all nationalities, commandeering their cargoes and enslaving their crews and passengers. And one historian has estimated that about 1.5 million white slaves from Christendom were taken by these Muslim marauders in those three centuries. And this is small compared to the 12 million black Africans shamefully enslaved by white colonialists, but shocking nonetheless. And although 17th century English people were very well aware of the problem, Samuel Pepys refers to meeting two ex-Algerian slaves in London in 1661, it's a story which is largely forgotten in modern times. Well, the pirates had a twofold purpose in taking all these people. First, to demand lucrative ransoms for the slaves' return. And this became a business in itself, with two Catholic missionary orders, the Trinitarians and the Mercedarians, being set up in the 16th century to facilitate the collection of money and negotiate the redemption of slaves on behalf of European states. Second, if ransoms were not forthcoming because the captives or their families were too poor, the purpose was to utilise them as slaves within their empire. And the whole system in the major cities of North Africa, Algiers, Tunis, Tripoli, Saleh, was based on slavery. Slaves were deployed in construction, in households, on farms, or worst of all, in the galleys, where men would be chained hand and foot for weeks in blazing heat and whipped mercilessly to make them row faster. If you were one of the 10% of females captured, you might well end up in a harem. Generally, slaves were regarded as a money-making opportunity for their masters, or patrons, as they called them. So, back to Oakley's story. After the pirates captured their ships, the passengers were imprisoned in the hold for weeks on end. There they found many other Englishmen who could offer them no comfort about the prospect ahead. But from them, the new slaves did learn something useful, a smattering of lingua franca, the common pidgin language spoken in the colonies between masters and slaves. And it was based mostly on the Spanish and Italian spoken by many of the slaves, with gaps filled in with words from Arabic, Turkish and Greek. And after sailing for 5 to 6 weeks, they arrived at their destination, Algiers. Now, Oakley describes Algiers as pleasantly situated on the side of hills overlooking the Mediterranean, with a sweeping bay and a commodious harbour. It was a large city, surrounded by 3 miles of walls, with 5 fortified gates, which made it virtually impregnable. It had numerous beautiful private and public buildings, many built with slave labour. The population of Algiers at this time was about 80,000, but this included at least 25,000 slaves of all nationalities. It was the largest of all the slaving centres. Oakley says that Algiers was, quotes, infamous for being the nest of those Turkish corsairs which have long tyrannised the neighbouring seas. And although it may have been a fair city, dryly comments, there is no such thing as a fair prison. The first night ashore, the new slaves were locked down in a deep, nasty cellar, or bagnio, the name being taken from bathhouses, but now were foul prisons. It was customary for all slaves who'd been occupied in various tasks throughout the city in the day to be locked down in these bagnios every evening. The viceroy had his first pick of 10% of the best slaves, and the remaining slaves were driven to market like beasts on the next market day, where they were paraded up and down, bidders shouted out offers, and there was much haggling. Their limbs were felt, and their mouths were looked into like horses. But not to determine age, but rather to see what their teeth were like. A full set of grinders increased your price, because this meant you were capable of chewing the hard black bread, which was a staple food. If you couldn't eat, you couldn't work. Hands were examined. If you had calloused and brawny hands, you would be good for hard manual labour. But soft, delicate hands might indicate a wealthy gentleman or merchant for whom a big ransom could be expected. And they would be regarded as an investment and might hope for better treatment. But some of the slaves were in such a poor condition and so plentiful that it was said that on occasions they could be purchased for the price of an onion. Oakley does not express any expectation of being ransomed, but for others of higher status captured with him, this was a possibility. John Butler, a mining expert, was the subject of a £50 advance from the Providence Island Company towards his ransom, though we don't know if it was actually achieved. Another slave from the Mary, John Simons, wrote to Lord Mandeville in November 1639, describing the awful plight of the 2,000 or so English slaves in Algiers and appealing for assistance. And it's estimated that not more than 3 to 4% of slaves could hope to be ransomed, and that nearly a sixth of slaves died each year. And over the next few years, Oakley had the opportunity to observe many things about the society that he now lived under. He perceived that many of the Muslims were hypocritical in their profession. While, for example, they strictly observed Ramadan during the day, they indulged in feasting and drunken revelry at night. Often slaves were pressed to forsake Christianity to become Muslims, turn Turk or take the turban, as it was commonly called. This involved public circumcision and the giving of a new Islamic name. These converts were called renegados or renegades, and officially they were no longer slaves and were thus exempt from service on the dreaded galleys. But woe betide any who subsequently changed their mind. Their masters would show no mercy to any who revolted from Islam once they had professed it. Oakley tells of a Spanish friar who had converted to Islam. When he later renounced the faith, he was burnt to death. A drunken slave who turned renegado but continued to drink was punished by hundreds of violent blows. But the threat of arbitrary cruelty always hung over the slaves. They could be savagely beaten at will. A patron would suffer greater penalties for killing his horse than his slave. But Oakley cynically comments that their cruelty was only exceeded by their covetousness, saying, "Could they make as much of us dead as they make alive, we were well assured which way it would have gone with us." One of the most popular methods of punishment was by the batoon, whereby the victim's legs were inserted into a piece of wood from which he was hung upside down, his weight resting on his neck and shoulders, and beaten on the soles of his feet with a short truncheon, as many blows as were ordered. And this resulted in lameness, if not worse. William Oakley was sold to a Tagarene, that is, someone whose family was descended from the Moors expelled from Spain by Ferdinand the Great in the 16th century. Shakespeare's Moor of Venice, Othello, was similarly proud to have this heritage. Oakley's new master was a quick-tempered man, and Oakley's naivety nearly cost him his life right at the outset of his captivity. When he was taken into his master's house, his master's father insulted his Christian faith. Oakley hadn't yet been broken by bondage, so he answered back by insulting the prophet Muhammad. Not a wise thing to do. Oakley narrowly escaped with his life, saved only by the intervention of his master's wife. And Oakley says that from this episode, he learned that slaves must not expect to have free tongues or revile another's religion, however erroneous. For the first 6 months as a slave, Oakley was employed on various errands. He learned absolute obedience to whatever commands he was given. Then Oakley's master told him that he must go to sea in a ship, despite his pleas that he wouldn't be much use, as he knew nothing of the mariner's art. He must have had a deep fear of being a galley slave or galliotti, and also worried that even if he was only handling tackle, he might be involved in fighting against other Christians. But his patron said he must go, and go I did. Oakley spent 9 weeks at sea, but in the providence of God he avoided the worst treatment. And when he returned to Algiers, Oakley's master, who was in financial difficulties, informed him that he was going to be leased out, which meant that he must find his own occupation in the city and pay his master $2 a month. Dire consequences would result if the due money wasn't paid on time. And this system of leasing out was in widespread use, and slaves would try to raise the required amount by running errands, carrying water from fountains, begging, setting up little stalls, or in desperation, stealing. Oakley was in an impossible situation. He'd been given no money to start up with, he had no useful trade, and there were so many other slaves competing with each other. Oakley had some hopes of learning a trade with an English tailor, but these came to nothing. You might say he wasn't cut out for it. All he could do at his lowest point was trust in God and pray for his help. Finally, wandering around in his extremity and, quotes, not knowing where to levy the least mite of the $2, Oakley says that Providence directed him to another Englishman about to set up a little shop selling alcohol, tobacco and other commodities. And slaves were often able to succeed in this sort of venture because although Muslims were barred from trading in alcohol, many enjoyed an illicit tipple. So when this slave invited Oakley to become his partner, it seemed too good a deal to be refused. So he pleaded with his patron to give him a bit of money to buy initial stock. And the partnership soon began to make a decent profit. But unfortunately, his partner started drinking and all of the work fell on Oakley's shoulders. But he was able to meet his patron's demands and was also the means of helping another slave, John Randall, a former gunner on Providence Island, who'd also been captured aboard the Mary with his wife and child as he sought to return to the island. Randall was destitute, unable to get any money to give his patron, and came begging at Oakley's door. Oakley says, "Shall I shut the door or my heart upon him when God hath opened a door of hope to me in the day of my trouble? Shall I so ill requite the Lord's kindness to me?" And Oakley offered Randall free accommodation in the shop and suggested that he learned how to make canvas clothes for seamen, knowing that as a glover by trade, he would already be skilled with a needle. But soon, John Randall began to work alongside his friend in the shop as the business prospered. One day, the two men decided to go for a walk to get some fresh air. They were allowed to go out of the town for about a mile, which was called the end of our tether. As they walked along the coast, they discussed, theoretically, the possibility of escape, but they had no idea of actually forming a plan. However, some of the spies, who constantly watched every movement of the slaves in case they ran away, seized them and charged them with attempting to escape. Despite their protestations of innocence, they were marched back into the city and brought before the viceroy, who had them chained up in the prison until their patrons should get them out. They suffered different fates. Randall's patron commanded 300 blows on the sole of his feet in the battoon, which left him lame, whereas Oakley's called him names and ordered him to work on the looms with some English cloth workers. Oakley turned out to be so useless and bungling at this craft that he was soon taken off it. And in this period of absence from the shop, it was broken into and most of the goods stolen, except for the money that Oakley had been hiding in the ground. But despite now having nothing to sell, Oakley's unsympathetic patron told him to continue trading and pay his dues as before. And Oakley worked as a shopkeeper for 3 to 4 years, but with no security because he was always at the whims of his patron. He says that as the years passed, the truth is, in time, we were so habituated to bondage that we almost forgot liberty and grew stupid and senseless of our slavery, and were in danger to be like those Israelites in Babylon, in 1 Chronicles chapter 4, who being once settled, forgot Canaan and dwelt with the king for his work. And he continued, long bondage breaks the spirit. It scatters hope off and discourages all attempts for freedom. Other evils too attended their condition. There was the perpetual temptation to deny the Lord, to make our souls slaves, that our bodies might recover liberty. And Oakley is talking here about the temptation to renounce Christianity and become a Muslim, saying, how many have made shipwreck of faith that they might not be chained to the galleys? And they had no preaching of the word of God to encourage them. There were Catholic chapels and priests in the banyos, which the masters allowed because it kept the slaves more compliant, as well as providing basic medical services and facilitating the ransom procedures. But at the time, there were no evangelical English-speaking ministers among the slaves. But God had not forgotten them in their bondage. Oakley was soon able to report that God looked on our affliction and was pleased to mitigate the load of our captivity. A young minister of the gospel called Devereux Spratt, which is a wonderful fishy name for a sea story, well, he had recently been captured on an English ship as he attempted to flee from the troubles in Ireland and brought to Algiers as a slave. Oakley and a group of Christians among the existing slaves humbly asked Spratt if they might enjoy the benefits of his ministry, and they managed to scrape together some money from their meagre earnings to provide for him. And so Spratt preached 3 times a week to about 60 to 80 Protestant believers in a cellar. The masters didn't bother as long as they continued to pay their dues and didn't attempt to criticise Islam. Says Oakley, thus was our God pleased to give us the means of strengthening our faith and comforting our drooping spirits. And this benefit lasted for the rest of his captivity. But after Oakley's imprisonment, things seemed even more hopeless, with no prospect of deliverance from slavery. However, Oakley observes that it is often said, the night is always darkest towards daybreak, and God is often drawing nearer to us in mercy when we can see he is departing further off in displeasure. Oakley's patron became bankrupt and was forced to sell off all his slaves to pay for his debts. Oakley didn't expect this to make much difference to him. He would still be a slave, just with a different master. But he prayed that God would save him from being sold to a cruel new patron. And God mercifully heard Oakley's prayer. He was assigned to an old gentleman who showed him great love and kindness. Oakley declared, I could not have met with more respect nor been treated with more tenderness had I been his son. Well, this new master had a farm about 12 miles out of the city. When he took Oakley there to show him around, Oakley thought that his patron intended him to manage this farm. And Oakley appreciated his master's kindness, but he realised that if he gave up his shop, he would lose any hope of ridding himself of slavery. He mused, Fetters of gold do not lose their nature, they are fetters still. But the changed circumstances galvanised his mind, which had grown dull and listless, and he began to resolve to make an escape attempt, finally settling on a scheme that seemed to me feasible and practicable. Now, as the plan was taking shape in his mind, Oakley had some qualms of conscience about deserting his kind master, and the prudence of leaving a safe situation to return to England, where things could be a lot worse for him because of the civil war that was then raging. But he resolved his doubts with a thought of liberty. Once settled on a plan, Oakley wisely decided to run it past some impartial friends who he could trust to give their honest opinion. And the three men were people who wouldn't be involved in the plan itself for different reasons. The first was his minister, Devereux Spratt, who was already in the negotiation process for being ransomed himself. Secondly, an elderly saint called Robert Lake, who was too old to run the risk. And then his dear friend, John Randall, who was ruled out because he had a wife and child who couldn't be left behind. All three men judged the plan to have a possibility of succeeding and gave it their blessing. But there was a happy ending for these men too. It wasn't long before Devereux Spratt was released, and 2 years later, in 1646, Robert Lake and the Randall family were among the 244 captives redeemed in a mission sponsored by the English Parliament. Before revealing the plan to anyone, Oakley demanded that they swear an oath not to reveal it to a soul. As leader, Oakley ran the greatest risk if they were discovered. Look at what had happened before, when he was merely suspected of trying to escape. The difficult task of choosing accomplices for the scheme came next. Oakley had three criteria for selection. One, they must have the necessary skills to build a boat. Two, they must be absolutely trusted to keep the plan secret. And three, they must possess the physical and mental strength to execute the plan. And Oakley whittled it down to seven people whom he judged fit to participate. The seven were John Anthony, a slave for 15 years and a carpenter by trade. William Adams, 11 years a slave and a bricklayer. John Jeffs, 5 years a slave and a mariner. Another John, surname not given, 5 years a slave, another carpenter described as lusty and strong. And two unnamed men who were useful because they were employed in washing underwear at the seaside, so they had a legitimate reason to be there. And of course, William Oakley himself. The plan Oakley revealed to his new accomplices was to make a boat, which could be taken apart again, divided into parcels, which then could be smuggled out of the city, hidden and reassembled at the time of escape. This boat, Oakley told them, might, by the superintendency of divine providence, prove an ark to deliver us out of the hands of our enemies. At first, everyone was excited, but then reality began to sink in. There seemed so many insuperable difficulties. Where should the boat be built? Where should it be launched? How could they avoid the eyes of the spies who watched them constantly? How could they get out of the city at night when the walls were so high and the gates locked and guarded? How would food be provided for the journey? Oakley had anticipated these objections in advance, so was able to deal with them one by one to the other's satisfaction. But he told them that if we never attempted anything until we'd answered all objections, we must sit with our fingers in our mouths all our days and pine and languish out our tedious lives in bondage. Let us be up and doing, and God would be with us. To begin is one half of the work. In other words, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And so they all solemnly agreed to risk everything to gain their liberty. While all the planning for escape was going on, Oakley continued to trade in his shop and paid his dues to his patron, but secretly he sold off most of his stock so that he'd have ready money available. This he hid in the bottom of a chest with a false bottom, which he entrusted to their minister, Mr. Spratt, who was about to get his discharge, with the promise of return should Oakley make it back to England. And Oakley describes the secret making of the boat in his cellar. I'll spare you the details, but he explains how they construct a wooden keel, ribs and seats, all jointed and designed to be dismantled and reassembled. They decide to cover the boat with a waterproof tarpaulin, made from a double-folded canvas and coated with a mixture of pitch, tar and tallow. Oakley and two of the carpenters set about melting down the materials to coat the cover, but are overcome by the fumes in the confined space of the cellar. So they have to leave the cellar door open and trust to God's protection. Once they had made and fitted all the component parts together, they took the boat to pieces and plotted how to smuggle the parcels containing the various bits out of the city to safe hiding places. The keel was taken out by the bricklayer William Adams, who often had to go outside the town for his employment, carrying pieces of wood to level his work. He set off, wearing his bricklayer's apron, trowel in hand, one of the keel pieces over his shoulder. No one suspected him, and he was able to hide it underneath a hedge. The jointed ribs were folded up, taken out of the city in a bag of underclothes, by one whose job it was to wash them at the seaside, and hidden not far from the keel. The tarpaulin caused the most problem because of its bulk, and eventually they decided to put it in the bottom of a large sack, covered over by a pillow, and committed it again to the clothes washer. The other necessities for their escape bid, a canvas sail and crudely crafted oars, were assembled. For provisions, they felt that only a small quantity of bread and two goatskin bottles of fresh water would be sufficient, because whatever happened, whether they arrived safely at land, drowned or recaptured, they wouldn't be long at sea. Oakley's job was to take the sail out, but he hadn't gone very far when, glancing back, he spotted the same spy who'd given him trouble before following him. Oakley's heart began to beat very fast, and he was sure that guilt was written all over his face. Was their brave venture going to fail before it had even begun? But suddenly he saw an English slave washing clothes by the sea, and his spirits lifted. Oakley approached and asked this slave if he would help him to wash the canvas. The spy came and stood on an overhanging rock above them, and watched as they washed the canvas and spread it out on a rock to dry. And then he walked off. He suspected nothing. Oakley was scared, though, that the spy might ambush him on his return to the city. So he rolled the canvas back up and took it back in with him. And when Oakley told his comrades what had happened, they became very jittery. But he succeeded in his second attempt to smuggle the tarpaulin out. All was now ready. They made their final plans to meet up an hour after nightfall on a hill about half a mile from the sea to reassemble the boat. Till then, they would split up and lie low. Nerves were on edge as the conspirators commenced putting their plan into action. When they got to the agreed meeting place on the hill, they changed their minds, quote, without any visible reason, and decided to go for a sheltered valley instead. They didn't know why at the time, but they soon saw why God had overruled our purposes. As two of the company went to retrieve the parcels hidden near the top of the hill, they heard dogs barking. They threw themselves to the ground and froze. The dogs and the men accompanying them passed by without discovering them. Trembling, they got the things and returned. All of the scattered bits were brought together as quickly as possible. There was no time to lose. As they hastily assembled the boat, they could hear people working in nearby gardens, so they didn't speak to each other but communicated by hand signals. Last of all, the double canvas case was put on. Oakley comments, "It felt like putting a winding sheet on our boat to be a coffin for us all." And the four men carrying the makeshift boat on their shoulders to the water's edge were like pallbearers carrying that coffin to the grave. People from the gardens cried out, "Who goes there?" as they passed. But they crept on silently in the dark without replying. When they got to the shore, they stripped off and carried the boat out as far as they could wade to avoid it being torn on rocks or stones. But as the seven men got into the boat, they realised that they'd miscalculated the weight that the vessel could hold. Immediately, water began to come over the sides. An urgent discussion ensued. One of the men who'd lost his nerve agreed to be left behind. But when they tried again, the boat was still overladen with six. More frantic discussions. Finally, another agreed to drop out. They were left with five men, which the boat seemed able to cope with. "So now," says Oakley, "it was time to commit and commend ourselves and our vessel to the protection and conduct of that God who rules the winds and the waves and whose kingdom is in the deep waters. Imploring mercy for the pardon of our sins and resigning up our souls to God, as if we had been presently to suffer death by the hand of the executioner, and taking farewell of our two companions whom we left behind, and wishing them as much happiness as could be hoped for in slavery, and they to us as long a life as could be expected by men going to their graves. So we launched out upon the 30th day of June, in the year of our Lord, 1644, a night forever to be remembered." They were aiming to reach Majorca, just a few miles away across the Mediterranean. Oakley comments that, "We are now out at sea, without helm or pilot, without anchor, tackle or compass, but God was these, all these, and more than all these." With such a small company, they all had to pull their weight. They couldn't afford even one idle finger. Four men worked continuously on the oars. The fifth was occupied bailing out water, which began to seep into the bottom of the boat. They worked really hard that first night, anxious to get out of the sight of their old masters. But when daylight broke, they were still within view of the ships that lay in the sea roads beyond the haven. Fortunately, their craft was so small and low in the water, which meant that they escaped notice. Fear of being captured and chained to the galleys made them redouble their efforts. They now discovered that their bread was ruined because it had been lying in seawater. It was, quote, "like a drunken toast, sopped in brine." Sounds lovely. And their fresh water stank of the tanned skins of the bottles, made them nauseous when they drank it. However, driven on by hope and careful rationing, they carried on for 3 days without complaint before pale famine stared us in the face. Oakley says that they would have been glad to eat the grass and excrement that slaves on land were sometimes driven to. For drink, they had two choices, either seawater or their own urine. They chose the latter, he said, but after a while they had to drink the former to make the latter, and that only made them thirstier. And the wind was against them. They used all their strength in rowing just to stand still. They were exhausted, but were getting nowhere. It felt as if God must be against them too, and disheartened, they thought it might be better to return to Algiers. However, while they still had breath, they vowed to struggle on. "And now," says Oakley, "the great God interposed. He rebuked his wind, and it became our friend." And in the change of wind direction, Oakley could trace God's sovereign power. It was perfect. just a slight difference in direction or power of the wind would have led to them perishing in the deep. Oakley reflected, but we see that our times are in God's hand, the ocean in the hollow of the same hand, and happy it was for us that we and they were all there. The blazing sun scorched their naked bodies, the man bailing threw seawater over them in an effort to cool them, but this resulted in huge, painful blisters rising all over their skin. Oakley laments, great pain we felt, great danger we were in, great miseries we endured, great wants we were under, and we had nothing little but hope, food and strength. One of the men had a pocket dial, which they used to steer their course by day, and at night they navigated by the stars when they were visible. And they continued in this desperate state for 4 days and nights. But as the fifth day dawned, they were on the brink of despair. They had no strength left. They laid down their oars, only carried on emptying the water. We were, says Oakley, loath to drown, loath to die, yet knew no ways to avoid death. Their only desire was that a passing ship might pick them up, even if it was an Algerian one that would take them back to captivity, like the children of Israel wishing to return to the slavery of Egypt. Oakley confesses, we would have accepted life upon any terms. But when they were at this dead ebb of hope, he says, God sent them some relief. Quote, the great God, whose most glorious opportunity to help is his creature's extremity. This help came in the form of what Oakley calls a novelty of providence. A sea tortoise, drifting in the sea, asleep, not far from them. Had the great Sir Francis Drake discovered the Spanish treasure fleet, Oakley says, he could not have more rejoiced. And Oakley describes how they were galvanised into action, rowing swiftly to the tortoise, dragging it into the boat, cutting off its head, drinking the blood, eating the liver and sucking the flesh. Like persons raised from the dead, refreshed and reinvigorated, they picked up their oars again, and about noon they thought that they could see land on the horizon. But having seen nothing but sea and sky for 5 days and nights, they were so scared to trust their eyes in case they were deceiving them. But as they rowed on, they became increasingly confident that it was indeed land. Oakley declares, I hope I shall never forget what a sense we had of God's goodness upon that assurance. The extreme heat had driven them all a bit crazy, and as they saw land approaching, they leapt into the sea, swimming around to cool their burnt bodies. They gave no thought to the shock their systems might experience from plunging into cold water or the possibility of shark attack. But God delivered them from their own folly. After a while, they got back into the boat and promptly fell soundly asleep. Again, God kept them, ensuring enough sleep to refresh them, but not too much that they would have drowned in their own boat as the water continued to seep in. Once awake, they rowed with renewed vigour, hoping to make landfall by night. However, they made slower progress than they wished, and towards nightfall spotted another island. The first they'd seen was Majorca, the second, Formentera. Believing that Formentera was infested with deadly snakes, they headed for Majorca. All that night they rowed, and much of the next day, their sixth at sea, until about 10 o'clock at night, they came under the steep cliffs of the island and looked for a place to land. While under the rocks, a vessel passed very close to them. It was a Turkish corsair. They were struck with fear that just when the safety of land was in their grasp, they were going to be recaptured. However, the ship passed them by. They crept along the coast, hugging the shore until they found a suitable spot to land their weather-beaten boat. When they came to land, they confessed that God had done great things for them. But just how great things were beyond their comprehension at this point. They were like men in a dream, starving, dehydrated and weak, with many dangers still to face on land before they could be considered safe. Leaving the boat behind them, Oakley describes the search for fresh water and food, how in their hunger they were glad to eat mouldy cake thrown to them. But their throats were so parched at first, they couldn't even swallow the water. They found themselves quarrelling, whereas before they'd been united. Their feet were so painfully blistered by being pickled in seawater, they could barely hobble along. And because of their wild and scruffy appearance, people thought they were beggars or thieves. They were threatened with a shotgun at one point. But they also met with kindness as islanders gave them fresh food and drink. A crowd gathered round them as they entered the city of Palma, wanting to know who these ragged strangers were. The viceroy cross-examined them too, before ordering that they should be maintained at his expense until passage to their own country could be obtained. And Oakley was grateful for money collected by the local people to buy them clothes and food, but particularly for the reminder given him by a young man he met while walking around the city. This young man, on learning that Oakley was one of those who'd come over in the canvas boat, said, "It was not the little boat, but the great God that brought you over." And in the years that followed, Oakley remarked that he'd often thought about the young man's words and been challenged by the fact that he had not, quotes, "hitherto more publicly owned God in his gracious and wonderful deliverance." And that was what motivated him to write of the great things that God had done for him. Oakley goes on to recount a series of providences which finally brought all of the men safe home from Majorca to England, saying, "The great God who began to work for us perfected his work concerning us." From Majorca, they travelled aboard a Spanish vessel to Alicante on the Costa Blanca. From Alicante, they got passage on an English ship bound for England. While sailing near Gibraltar, they were hotly pursued by Turkish pirates, but were able to take refuge in the harbour. Oakley and two of his companions were so shaken by this close shave that they went ashore at Gibraltar, while the other two opted to stay with the ship and actually arrived in England before them. Oakley and his two friends decided to travel to Cadiz by foot, which was a journey of about 60 miles or so. But before they set off, a small Spanish vessel bound for Cadiz arrived and offered them a free passage, so they arrived much more quickly. From Cadiz, they walked 12 miles up the coast to San Lucas, having heard that there they might catch a ship bound for England. The ship didn't really have space for them, but the young son of the ship's master successfully pleaded on their behalf. While waiting for their ship to embark, Oakley mentions the kindness of another English seafarer, Captain Goodson, who was in harbour at the same time. William Goodson was a fellow believer who became part of the independent congregation in Wapping, and he later served as Vice Admiral in Cromwell's Navy. Finally, the ship set sail for England, but it took 5 weeks to reach the Downs because of contrary winds. They set foot in England again in September 1644, with the country in the throes of civil war. And there, William Oakley's story ends. His little boat was hung up outside the church in Majorca, and its remains were seen by English visitors as late as 1671. Oakley lived for at least another 30 years after his escape, and he says that in the years since, he has had, quotes, "signal deliverances from imminent dangers," but we're not told what they were. It's possible that he may have associated with some of the radical church groups that flourished in London and the Home Counties during Cromwell's protectorate. In those circles, Oakley may well have heard the preaching of Thomas Brooks, a friend of Captain Goodson. He may even have come across Susanna Bell, but this is all conjecture. But there is a dark irony to William Oakley's story, of which he may have been unaware. His experience involved Islamic piracy and slavery. But if he'd arrived in Providence Island, he would have witnessed Christian men overseeing the toil of black slaves, some of whom had been captured by English pirates from the Spanish. A few of those slaves attempted to escape in boats stolen from their masters. If Oakley had lived on Providence Island, he might not have reached the opinion with which he justified his escape bid, that man is too noble a creature to be made subject to a deed of bargain and sale. The academic historian Karen Kupperman points out the hypocrisy of the Providence Island Puritan slave owners, who, with an avowed intention of bringing true religion to the heathen, nevertheless made no attempt to teach their slaves about Christianity, because if this led to their conversion, they would be rendered unfit for slavery. And she concludes that these staunch Puritans thus turned their back on human beings in need, men and women who were in their power. A system in the colonies which afforded opportunities for young English men and women to end their servitude, she says, ultimately turned planters in the direction of unending servitude for African men and women who were forced to accept an odious condition. So, in conclusion, William Oakley lists 8 lessons that he wishes his readers to learn from his narrative. 1. Learn to acknowledge God in all things. The sovereign God, states Oakley, can accomplish the most noble works with the most unfit instruments. And God uses second causes to achieve his purposes, quote, not because he cannot work without them, but to teach us to admire his strength in their weakness, his all-sufficiency in their insufficiency. And he goes on, the same God who in an ark of bulrushes preserved Moses and in another ark saved Noah, in a small canvas sculler, which was our ark, wafted us over the ocean and brought us all safe to land. As God is seen in the smallest works of his creation, so in the smallest instruments of his providence. The glory of the great wise king shines greatly in the smallest thing. Indeed, our whole passage was wonder. 2. Learn to strengthen your faith against doubting objectors. Many people, says Oakley, like to devise clever arguments to disprove the historical providences of God recorded in the Old Testament, such as the preservation of Noah and his family in the ark. But the experiences of Oakley and his companions are a living testimony to such things really happening. If you can believe our story, he says, that God could preserve the lives of 5 useless, ordinary people in a poorly constructed canvas boat without anchor, compass or proper provisions after 6 days at sea and land them safe on land, then how far more easily can you, quote, credit the report how the same God should preserve 8 persons upon whose lives the repeopling of the whole world did depend, in a vessel of most exact proportions, strongly built and well laid in with all manner of provision. 3. Learn not to overlook God's providences in your own life. And Oakley warns his readers not to be so caught up with the miraculous providences of God so apparent in his story that they overlook how God has been working in their own lives every moment of every day. Your experiences, he says, may not be so dramatic or unusual, yet may have in them as much of real power, wisdom and goodness. Oakley asks, dost thou admire God in our preservation? Learn to admire him in thy own. Art thou surprised with wonder that we were kept a few days when there was not half an inch between us and death? Consider, God has kept thee many days and many years, and every minute of those many days and years, when there was but a hair's breadth between thee and death. Dost thou then admire how God preserved us alive in a vessel of cloth? Admire that God that holdeth thy soul in life. And that in a more frail vessel, a vessel of clay. Dost thou still wonder we were not blown over with every breath of wind? Admire also that the lamp of thy life, which thou carriest in a paper lantern, is not blown out by every blast of sickness. But if thou wilt still wonder how such a boat should carry us, then wonder also how thy food nourishes thee, thy clothes keep thee warm, how thy sleep refreshes thee. There's not a moment in our lives that is filled with real miracle and wonder. I will praise thee, says the psalmist, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Let us all, urges Oakley, praise God, for we are fearfully and wonderfully preserved. 4. Learn to prize your own liberty. Oakley warns us to learn from his slavery to value our own freedom and not abuse it, saying, if we serve not our God sincerely, and cheerfully in plenty, he can send us where we shall serve our enemies in want. If we glorify him not with our liberty, but turn it into licentiousness, he can clap us close, where we shall learn to prize it higher and wish we had improved it better. God had taught Judah by the captivity of Babylon to prize the freedom of Canaan, says Oakley, and we might learn our duty much cheaper from God's word, but we, like truants, will not learn it there till God sends us to school with a rod at our backs. 5. Learn to be content in all circumstances where God's providence has placed you. And Oakley here addresses servants who have Christian masters, but who grumble about them, even though those masters may pray with them. It's a lot worse to be the slave of an imperious Turk, he tells them, one who would curse and torture thee and make little provision for thy body and none at all for thy soul. A dose of such slavery would, says Oakley, soon cure such a servant of that restive spirit of grumbling and disobedience. If Christ has set you free, Oakley declares, you have become a servant to the best of masters and are employed in the most honourable services with expectation of the most glorious rewards. So learn to obey cheerfully. 6. Let all learn to walk worthy of the gospel, or it will be taken away. The gospel is that which sweetens all our mercies and mitigates the bitterness of all afflictions, says Oakley. But if, as a nation, we choose to sin away those blessings by walking in darkness, then God is justified in removing them from us. God can, quotes, overspread our habitations with Egyptian or Babylonish, Turkish or Popish darkness. God can carry us to Rome or Algiers, or else send Rome and Algiers home to us. For what should a people do with light that only intend to play or fight by it? Oakley then points to the fate of once famous churches in Asia and North Africa, now overrun by Islamic powers, something he had witnessed firsthand. And thinkest thou, O man, O Christian, that thou that doest these things so alien from the gospel of Christ, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God? I tell thee nay, and I tell all those that read these lines and are guilty, and I tell myself, so far as I am guilty, that except we repent, we shall all likewise perish. God had removed the candlestick from the church of Ephesus, Oakley reminded them, and the same could happen in England unless people repented. I've often wondered, says Oakley, what should be the grounds of their confidence, who speak as if the gospel were entailed upon England by virtue of some ancient charter, as if God would make us exceptions from his general rule, which is to take away abused, despised means and mercies. Was this the reason, he muses, that religion had fled to America, where she might find better quarter. 7. Let it be every man's care to be found in God's way. The promise of God's protection and blessing, says Oakley, is always linked to being in God's way. If we're overtaken by any affliction, we must first ask ourselves if we're walking in God's way, doing his work and serving his glory. For himself, Oakley is satisfied that when he set out for Providence Island, he was being obedient to God's will. But if any should doubt that, he says, let none imitate us wherein we failed, but rather admire divine condescension that engaged in our deliverance, notwithstanding our failing. 8, and finally, learn never to expect too much from men. Oakley observes that through all his adventures, we ever found most favour of God when we expected least from men. The compassion that they met with at Mallorca came from Spanish Catholics, whereas those people from whom they might reasonably have expected the greatest kindness, English Protestants, were often the ones that showed them the least. Thus, Oakley comments, when we met with disappointment, God would teach us the folly of idolising the creature. And I'd just like to end with Oakley's own expression of gratitude to the God who saved him, echoing the words of Psalm 136. He says, having overcome all these difficulties, I do here erect my Ebenezer as a small monument of great mercy and as an obligation upon my soul to great duty, and do pray that it may stand as an abiding witness for God in my conscience, that whenever I am tempted to sin, I may have an answer ready to stop the mouth of the tempter with indignation. How can I do this great evil and sin against my good God? When I am tempted to distrust, I may encourage my faith from my own narrative, saying, remember that God who delivered thee at sea. When I am tempted to murmur, I may suppress those mutinous thoughts from my own narrative, saying, remember what thou endurest in Algiers. When my heart grows cold and unthankful, I may chide and shame it from my own narrative into gratitude to God, that God who remembered us in our low estate, for his mercy endureth forever. Who preserved us at the sea, the great sea, for his mercy endureth forever. And secured us in a boat, a contemptible boat, for his mercy endureth forever. Who gave us favour in the eyes of strangers, for his mercy endureth forever. And opened to us the hearts of enemies, for his mercy endureth forever. And taught us to look up to his never failing mercy when friends failed, for his mercy endureth forever. Who returned us safe to England, for his mercy endureth forever. We called upon him in the day of trouble. He delivered us, and we will glorify him. Thank you.